Imagine standing on this rugged, elevated road right along the coastline of Rhodes. You're staring down at this hidden horseshoe-shaped beach. It's got that crystal clear turquoise water. It's maybe a mile away, and it just looks like absolute
The
paradise.
dream vacation spot.
Right. But then, as you look at your GPS, reality sets in. Your rental car will just never, ever be able to get you there. There's
Yeah.
no road. There's no hidden dirt path. The geography has completely locked you out.
And that is honestly the ultimate tourist trap, isn't it?
Yeah.
We operate under this fundamental assumption that if we just rent a car and fill up the tank, an island is fully ours to conquer.
Right.
Like, we think the land map is the only map that matters.
Totally.
But on an island like Rhodes, the roadmap is actually live emission.
Which is exactly why we are taking this deep dive today. So, welcome, everyone.
Glad to be here.
We are looking at a really comprehensive travel and logistics dossier today. It's focused entirely on Rhodes, coastal cruises, and sailing experiences. And the mission for this deep dive is to basically shatter that landlocked illusion for you. We are going to unpack the crucial insights from this guide to help you understand why getting off the land isn't just, a fun add-on.
No, not at all.
It is the absolute only way to comprehend the true scale and character of Rhodes.
And we are going to look at the mechanics of how you actually pull that off, because the trap most tourists fall into is treating all boat trips as just interchangeable.
Oh, yeah, like they're all the same.
Right. They see a flyer for a boat, they book it, and they assume they are getting the definitive experience. But the reality of the agency is far more complex. I mean, timing, vessel type, and routing, they dictate everything.
Okay, let me hit you with the foundational number that makes all of this necessary. 220.
It's a big number.
Rhodes has over 220 kilometers of coastline. That is a massive perimeter for a Greek island. But a staggering percentage of that coastline consists of sheer drops, jagged rock formations, and these blind spots that are entirely inaccessible by any motorized land vehicle.
And when you realize that, the entire paradigm of your trip shifts.
Yeah.
Because you could be driving the most expensive luxury SUV on the island, and you're still essentially driving through a corridor with the blinds pulled halfway down.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
The water is where the island actually opens up. Coastal cruises cover these stretches of limestone cliffs and ancient maritime approaches that honestly have not changed since the Bronze Age.
Wow.
It offers a vantage point that landbound visitors are just completely oblivious to.
Okay, let's unpack this. To really grasp why you need to be on the water, we have to look at the dramatically split personality of this island's coastline.
Right, the geography.
Because the east and west coasts of Rhodes aren't just different, they're playing two entirely different sports.
Totally.
Reading through these geographical breakdowns in the guide, it feels like comparing two completely different venues. The east coast operates like an exclusive, sheltered VIP lounge.
I love that. That is a perfect way to conceptualize it. The geography of the East Coast is defined by these incredibly intricate rocky headlands. But more importantly, it's carved up into a series of deeply recessed coves. And what is critical to understand about these coves is their orientation.
Right.
They literally turn their backs on the interior of the island. They open exclusively toward the sea.
Which explains the blind spots. The island is physically hiding its best assets from anyone approaching from the center.
Exactly. The geology itself acts as a fortress against the roads.
Yeah.
And there's actually a meteorological reason for this VIP lounge atmosphere, too.
Okay, what's that?
The East Coast is the leeward side. It's naturally protected from the Meltemi.
Ah, the wind.
Right, the Meltemi is this relentless, dry, northern wind that just batters the Aegean during the summer. So because the East Coast is shielded, the water here stays remarkably flat and sheltered. It's, an aquatic sanctuary.
But then you cross over to the West Coast, and the VIP lounge just completely
Oh, it's
disappears.
gone.
Suddenly, you are standing in this wild, highly exposed outdoor theater. The topography is dramatically open to the elements. You have those prevailing winds whipping in. The water is entirely different.
And it all builds up to this incredible crescendo at the southern tip.
Yes, where the island just seemingly gives up and flattens out into the massive sandbar of Prestonici.
The contrast is staggering. And what's fascinating here is how this split geography totally dictates the human experience.
Right.
You have the sheltered sanctuary of the east, the wild expanse of the west, and right at the intersection around the Southern Cape and the stretches near Lindos and Anthony Quinn Bay, you find the visual payoff.
The really good stuff.
Yeah, this specific transitional zone contains some of the most heavily photographed water in the entire Mediterranean.
Which, considering the Mediterranean's reputation, is a massive claim.
It really is.
But it proves why the boat is non-negotiable. Because if you drive from a hotel to a specific beach on the East Coast, you get out, you set up your umbrella, and your entire context is just that one slice of sand.
Exactly. You are staring at a single painting.
Right. But a coastal cruise along this transition zone is like walking through the entire gallery.
You're experiencing the gradient of the island in real time. You actually feel the shift in the wind. You watch the jagged cliffs of the east melt into the dramatic flat expanse of the south.
You get a sense of scale.
A topographical drama that is literally impossible to perceive when you are, you know, navigating a winding asphalt road just looking for a parking spot.
So the geography demands you get on a boat. We've established the where.
Mm-hmm.
But this is where the logistics in our sources start getting really granular, because we have to shift from geography to the clock.
The when.
Right. Since these coasts are so fundamentally different, the time of day you choose to engage with them completely alters the physics of the trip.
Oh, totally. Timing on the agent is not an aesthetic choice. It's a structural one.
Mm.
The quality of your time on the water hinges entirely on your departure hour.
Let's look at the morning strategy first. The prevailing wisdom from the guide is that morning crossings offer two non-negotiable benefits.
Yep.
First, you get the absolute calmest sea conditions of the day. Second, you get this incredibly sharp, highly defined light for photographing the rocky headlands.
And there is a very basic thermal dynamic at play here. In the early morning, the landmass of Rhodes hasn't heated up yet.
Okay.
Because the land is cool, it isn't generating the thermal updrafts that pull the sea breezes in. So the water remains in this pristine, glassy state.
Wow, so it's like gliding over a mirror.
Exactly. If you want to drop anchor in one of those hidden eastern coves and see 50 feet straight down to the seabed with absolute clarity, you have to be there before the thermal winds wake up.
That makes total sense from a physics standpoint.
Yeah.
But I want to pivot to the evening, and here's where it gets really interesting. Because I am genuinely skeptical about one of the biggest recommendations in these sources.
Uh-oh, skepticism.
Look, there is a massive emphasis on evening boat trips. But let's be real for a second. If I am a traveler, and I have managed to secure a phenomenal table on a cliffside terrace on the West Coast, and I have a cocktail in my hand, why on earth would I pay for a boat ticket just to look at the exact same sunset?
Well, it is the most common pushback you hear, and on paper, it sounds logical.
Right. A sunset is a sunset.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, here's the trap most tourists fall into. They conflate a generic sunset sailing with a dedicated golden hour cruise. And these sources draw a very sharp line between the two.
Wait, really? I always assumed those were just interchangeable marketing buzzwords.
Not at all. The mechanics of the trips are completely different. A standard sunset sailing is usually just a broader coastal route.
Okay.
You are out on a boat. You do some sightseeing, and the sun going down is just kind of the grand finale as you head back to port.
Got it.
A true golden hour departure, however, is a highly calculated route designed exclusively around a specific meteorological window, that magical hour, right before the sun hits the horizon.
So it is about the physics of the light itself, rather than just waiting for the sky to get dark.
Precisely. These specific routes often hug the western coastline for a very deliberate reason. As the sun drops, you are looking out toward the mountainous Turkish coastline in the distance.
Oh, I see.
When you are on a cliff terrace, you are a spectator looking at the water. But when you are on the water during that hour, the sea surface actually acts as an infinite reflector.
Yeah, infinite reflector.
Yeah, it catches the amber and violet light bouncing off the Turkish mountains and the dropping sun. You aren't just watching the light. You are physically floating inside an immersive 360-degree light environment.
Oh, wow. Okay, I see the distinction now. On the cliff, you are sitting in the audience. On the boat, you are standing on the stage.
That's a great analogy.
The light isn't just something you are looking at. It is something you are physically moving through.
Which is why the evening cruise remains the highest rated experience for people who have already exhausted the land-based sites. It offers a sensory immersion that no piece of coastal real estate can replicate.
Okay, consider my skepticism officially cured.
Good to hear.
So we know the geography, and we know the thermal and optical physics of the timing. Let's get into the actual architecture of the voyage.
The boats.
Because you don't just show up to a dock and jump on whatever is floating.
Yeah.
You have to choose the right vessel and the right structure for your specific group.
Right. The vessel you choose dictates the limits of your exploration. It's essentially a choice between massive coverage and surgical precision.
Let's break that down. The sources outline full-day group cruises for the highly ambitious traveler.
Mm-hmm.
These are built for efficiency. You get the swimming stops in the famous bays, you pass the major landmarks, and you get these sweeping, continuous panoramas of the coastline. You are basically buying a ticket to see as much of Rhodes as humanly possible in 8 hours.
And it is a phenomenal way to check the boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But you are locked into a rigid, non-negotiable schedule.
Which brings us to the other end of the spectrum, the private yacht charter.
Right.
And I have to throw another piece of skepticism at you here.
Bring it on.
For a tourist who just wants to see the sights, isn't a private yacht charter an unnecessary luxury? I mean, if a group tour is hitting Anthony Quinn Bay, and the private yacht is hitting Anthony Quinn Bay, aren't you just paying a massive premium to look at the same rocks without strangers sitting next to you?
If you view it purely as a status symbol, yeah, maybe. But if you look at the navigational realities of the agent, the real luxury of a private charter is maneuverability.
Maneuverability.
Yeah. Let's talk about the draft of a boat. A large group catamaran or a multi-deck tour boat sits deep in the water and it's incredibly wide. When they approach that VIP lounge on the East Coast with all those jagged, intricate, hidden coves, they physically cannot get into the tightest, most secluded spots.
Because they're just too big.
Exactly. They have to anchor further out, or they just blow right past the smaller, unnamed anchorages because they simply don't fit, and they have 50 people demanding to get to the next scheduled stop.
So the big boats are literally barred from the deepest secrets of the coastline.
They are. A smaller private yacht, or a nimble sailboat, utilizes what maritime guides call the slow approach.
The slow approach.
They have the physical capability to thread the needle. They can glide into a shallow, sandy inlet that is only 50 feet wide, drop anchor, and suddenly you have a private beach that the mega tours just can't touch.
Wow. And I imagine the psychological luxury is just as important, especially if you aren't traveling solo.
Oh, it changes the entire dynamic of a vacation. Think about the reality of traveling with young children. A rigid group tour has a set timer. You have exactly 45 minutes to swim, and then the horn blows.
That sounds like a recipe for stress.
It is. With private charter, your group dictates the momentum. If the kids are fascinated by a school of fish in a completely random unnamed bay, you just stay there for 2 hours. You have purchased total autonomy over your time.
You are buying the ability to go completely off script.
Exactly.
I love that framing. All right, we have built the ultimate conceptual itinerary. Now let's look at the actual captain's log. We need to arm you, the listener, with the insider logistics so you don't make rookie mistakes when you actually try to execute this trip.
This is where a lot of dream vacations hit a wall.
Yeah.
Assuming you know how the maritime infrastructure works is a dangerous game.
Case in point, departures. The default setting for almost every tourist in Rhodes is to head straight to Mandrake Harbor in Rhodestown.
Yep.
It is iconic, it is historically significant, and it is also absolutely chaotic in the morning. But the sources highlight a critical insider tip. If you are focusing on those intricate East Coast coves, you do not have to start at Mandrake. Many of the smartest itineraries actually depart further south, from Falaraki or the East Coast Marina.
That is a massive logistical advantage. By bypassing Mandrake, you avoid the morning herd.
Right.
You are already positioned on the East Coast, meaning your boat spends less time transiting from the north and more time actually anchored in the spots you paid to see.
Now, what about the calendar? The season runs basically from April to October. That is a massive window.
It is, and this raises an important question. How do you optimize for comfort? Because the agency does not behave the same way in April as it does in August. You have to optimize for your specific tolerance of heat, wind, and crowds.
Well, the default tourist instinct is to book in July and August because that is peak summer.
Sure.
But the sources are flashing massive warning signs about that. If you insist on peak summer, you are entering a hyper-competitive market. You have to book your golden hour or private charters like 3 to 5 days in advance.
Minimum. And you are dealing with peak temperatures and the absolute peak ferocity of that Miltemi wind we discussed earlier.
Ah.
If you have the flexibility to manipulate your travel dates, there is a definitive, undeniable sweet spot for sailing the Dodecanese May, June, and September.
The Goldilocks zone.
Precisely. Uh-huh. In May and June, the sea has warmed up enough for comfortable swimming, but the massive crowds haven't arrived and the high summer winds haven't fully kicked in.
And
September is arguably even better. The sea has been baking in the Mediterranean sun all summer, so the water is like a warm bath, but the atmospheric temperature is finally dropping back down to a comfortable level.
So, what does this all mean? It means coming prepared. And I want to quickly relay the packing list from the guide.
Crucial stuff.
You're going to need swimwear, a towel, sun protection, a light layer for evening returns because it does get chilly, and deck shoes or sandals with grip. Oh, and a bonus, most boats provide snorkeling gear, so you don't even have to pack that.
Nice.
But wait, what about the person who is terrified of getting on a boat? We have to address the motion sickness factor, because all this talk of thermal updrafts and Meltemi winds might be terrifying for someone who gets, you know, green around the gills.
It is a totally valid concern, but it is completely manageable if you use the geography to your advantage.
Okay.
If you are prone to seasickness, you must adhere to two strict rules. Rule number one, stick exclusively to the East Coast. As we established, it's the leeward side. The island itself is blocking the wind, acting as a massive geological shield.
Right. And rule number two.
Only book morning departures. You want to be on the water before the afternoon. Thermal breezes agitate the surface. An East Coast morning charter is mathematically your safest bet for a perfectly smooth ride.
Incredible. So we have covered the physics, the geography, the timing, and the logistics. But as we wrap up this deep dive into the waters of Rhodes, we need to talk about the ultimate why.
Mm-hmm.
Because checking off the land-based ruins and the tourist restaurants is only really skimming the surface of what this destination actually represents. To truly grasp the island scale, from the dramatic West Coast sunsets to the hidden coves of the East, you just have to get out on the water.
To merely drive around Rhodes is to treat an ancient maritime empire like a modern theme park.
Wow, yeah.
The roads only show you what the 20th century decided was convenient to pave.
So, as you finalize your travel plans, we strongly encourage you to look at your map and identify the blind spots. Look for the jagged edges where the roads simply stop. Those are the places where the sea offers a profoundly different reality.
And if you need one final reason to justify stepping off the dock, I want you to consider a specific historical reality touched upon in our sources.
Okay.
They mention the experience of getting sea-level views of the Acropolis of Lindos. And I'd really want you to deeply internalize what that means.
The Acropolis of Lindos, I mean, it's this massive, imposing fortress built on a sheer cliff. When you arrive in a rental car, you park in a paved lot, you buy a ticket, and you walk up some stairs.
Right. It feels very domesticated.
Very.
But imagine approaching that exact same cliff face from the deck of a boat, a mile out at sea. The water level hasn't changed. The sheer vertical drop of the rock hasn't changed. When you approach Lindos from the water, you are adopting the exact visual perspective of an ancient mariner or an invading fleet from 3,000 years ago.
Wait, really? Just the pure scale of it?
You are looking up at this staggering, terrifying display of power exactly the way it was designed to be seen by the ancient world.
That gives me chills.
That is the ultimate value of a coastal cruise. You aren't just escaping the crowds or finding a better place to swim. By navigating the blind spots of the roadmap, you are stripping away the modern infrastructure. You are looking at the island exactly as the ancients first encountered it.
Wow.
You are, in the truest sense of the word, time traveling through geography.
I cannot think of a better thought to leave you with. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll see you next time.